This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he helped broker a 72-hour ceasefire in Sudan. Meanwhile, the White House says the U.S. is trying to help thousands of Americans left behind in Sudan escape fighting in the East African nation. That's after the U.S. Embassy evacuated all of its diplomatic personnel over the weekend and shut down. VOA Cindy Sain tells us more about the ongoing evacuation process for several countries during the ceasefire.
A UN convoy carrying 700 people completed a dangerous 850-kilometer trip from the embattled capital Khartoum to Port Sudan on the Red Sea coast. As foreign countries and organizations continued to extricate their personnel from the violence between the two warring factions in Sudan. On Saturday, the U.S. military sent three Chinook helicopters to evacuate the American Embassy staff from Khartoum. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Russia has threatened to scrap an initiative that enables the safe passage of grain from Ukrainian Black Sea ports to world markets after the group of seven leading industrial nations warned they may impose more sanctions against Russia.
Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, said Sunday that if such a ban happens, Moscow will terminate the Black Sea Grain Initiative. That agreement, brokered by the United Nations and Turkey, enables the vital export of grain from Ukraine's Black Sea ports to world markets through the joint inspection of vessels at a facility in Istanbul. Ukraine is the world's fifth biggest producer. Around 28 million tons of grain have been exported under the deal since July. Experts warn its termination could have a devastating impact amid a global food crisis.
VOA's Henry Ridgewell, this is VOA News. Kenya's president says the starvation deaths of dozens of followers of a pastor are akin to the results of terrorist acts, as the new death toll has risen to 73. He said the pastor, who was in police custody, should be in prison. Paul McKenzie was arrested on suspicion of telling his followers to fast to death in order to meet Jesus. The total death toll again at 73, with 26 new bodies exhumed Monday. The Kenya Red Cross Society on Sunday said 112 people have been reported missing at a tracing desk set up at Malindi, where the pastor's main church was located. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is vowing the new House Republican majority will approve a package this week that will raise the nation's debt limit and make steep budget cuts. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Speaker McCarthy says the vote will happen this week on a partisan package that would raise the debt limit by $1.5 trillion in exchange for steep cuts that some in his own party oppose. McCarthy is trying to entice President Joe Biden to the negotiating table. Action is needed to lift the borrowing cap to keep the government fully paying its bills in a matter of weeks. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries say they are unwilling to negotiate over the debt ceiling. McCarthy also has challenges with Republicans. The hard-right House Freedom Caucus has yet to bless McCarthy's proposal. Norman Hall, Washington.
Closing arguments are heard in the Capitol riot of a Proud Boys, so the trial of the Proud Boys National Chairman Enrique Tarrio and four lieutenants, APs Ed Donahue with more details.
Prosecutors say the Proud Boys were ready for all-out war and were foot soldiers for Donald Trump. The five are charged with seditious conspiracy, plotting to forcibly stop the transfer of power. Prosecutors have repeatedly shown jurors a video clip of Trump talking about the Proud Boys during his first presidential debate.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
Tarrio wasn't in Washington on the day of the riot. Defense attorney Nicholas Smith accused prosecutors of repeatedly playing the clip of Trump from the debate to try to manipulate jurors, and says there's no evidence of a plan to attack the Capitol. Seditious conspiracy is a Civil War era charge that is rare and can be difficult to prove. Ed Donahue, Washington.
After days of people forming long lines at gasoline, Cuba's fuel supply crisis has increased dramatically, with authorities now suspending some activities and rationing sales. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Was a return to conflict inevitable in Sudan, and could the U.S. and others have done more to secure its fragile peace agreement?
At the end of the day, the failure of everybody involved here is to listen to what the Sudanese themselves are saying.
Plus, Western allies at a U.N. meeting berate Russia's top diplomat over its invasion of Ukraine.
Russia has violated universal human rights and fundamental freedoms both outside and inside its own borders. It has violated international law.
And more people around the world are upping their expectations for good coffee, but how much is too much to spend on a quality cup of joe? Today is Tuesday, April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced that following intense negotiation over the past 48 hours, the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces agreed to implement a nationwide ceasefire starting at midnight Monday to last for 72 hours. The White House said the U.S. is trying to help thousands of Americans left behind in Sudan escape the fighting after the U.S. Embassy evacuated all of its diplomatic personnel over the weekend. At a news conference, Brigadier General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary, said two U.S. Navy vessels will soon be off the Sudan coast.
The idea here is to have these capabilities offshore available should we need, for example, to transport citizens to another location, should we need to provide medical care, those kinds of things. So again, positioning assets to be ready if asked and if needed.
Meanwhile, one analyst says the writing was on the wall that the leaders of the RSF and the army would turn on each other. Russia's wanted naval access to Sudan's Red Sea ports. The United Arab Emirates paid RSF leader Hamdi to help fight in Yemen. And Egypt has supported al-Burhan, sending troops and warplanes to the country. VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Rebecca Hamilton, professor of law at American University and the author of the book Fighting for Darfur, if the United States is at fault, worrying too much about countering Russian and Chinese influence in Sudan and not working harder to make sure the framework peace agreement would hold.
The role of the U.S. is distinctly different from the role of the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Egyptians. In that for the most part, the U.S. interest is in seeing a stable, democratic Sudan. Now, we can certainly have a long conversation about the ways in which the U.S. has tried to secure that and the multiple failures in terms of pushing for rushed peace agreements that are effectively just power sharing deals between men with guns. And what the Sudanese people have asked for, and that no one in the international community has ever really supported, is a truly inclusive peace process that brings in the marginalized communities, that brings in the women, that brings in the whole of Sudanese society. Because that process is something that diplomats are not really trained to do. They're trained to bring together whoever has the weaponry, sit them in a hotel room and sort of bash heads together until they get signatures on a piece of paper that divvies up the power. And then the diplomats say that's success and leave.
Well, that's a problem. I mean, if it's laid out like, you know, you say, then we sort of are guilty. If we go in a hotel room with these two generals and the other military types and say, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. We'll give you this, we'll give you that, you know, but you've got to agree with us and get them to sign on a piece of paper. Then we sort of are guilty. And as are some other Western nations, if we really didn't look at the long term and knowing these two are going for power, did we make a mistake?
So 100% I agree, and there is plenty of blame to go around in this situation. I still would maintain that it is different to, for example, the Emiratis supplying weaponry to Hamdi, who has a proven track record of being a war criminal. He is responsible for the atrocities in Darfur. So it is a different kind of blame to go around, but certainly plenty of guilty players here. And yes, I think at the end of the day, the failure of everybody involved here is to listen to what the Sudanese themselves are saying. The neighborhood resistance committees, which are Sudanese civil society, largely youth driven, that were really the backbone of the revolution that overthrew this 30-year dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, they are the ones that we should be listening to. That if we're really serious about democracy, then what they are calling for is what needs to be supported. And that is a long, hard and messy road. And that's why the tendency of external actors is to look at these committees and say what they're asking for is unrealistic and they need to be more pragmatic. But to be honest, at this point, whatever everybody else has been pushing for hasn't worked. And so maybe it is time to listen to what the Sudanese themselves are saying.
That's Rebecca Hamilton, professor of law at American University. She was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam, in Washington. The United Nations chief and representatives from Western nations berated Sergei Lavrov, Russia's top diplomat, as he chaired a UN meeting on Monday, accusing Moscow of violating the UN Charter by attacking Ukraine and occupying parts of its territory. The allies pointed to the Charter's underlying principle requiring all countries to support the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every nation, which Russia violated by invading its neighbor, our smaller neighbor, on February 24, 2022, and illegally annexing several regions. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield called Russia a hypocritical convener at the meeting.
Russia has violated universal human rights and fundamental freedoms both outside and inside its own borders. It has violated international law. That includes the wrongful detention of American citizens.
Lavrov responded by defending his country's military action and accusing the U.S. and its allies of undercutting global diplomacy. Well, Russia has threatened to scrap an initiative that enables the safe export of grain from Ukrainian Black Sea ports to the world market. The threat comes after members of the Group of Seven leading industrial nations warned they may impose further sanctions on Moscow over its invasion of Ukraine. We hear more now from Henry Ridgewell.
The Group of Seven leading industrial nations are considering a near total ban on all exports to Russia, according to Japan's Kyodo News Agency, citing Japanese government sources. Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, said Sunday that if such a ban happens, Moscow will terminate the Black Sea Grain Initiative. That agreement, brokered by the United Nations and Turkey, enables the vital export of grain from Ukraine's Black Sea ports to world markets through the joint inspection of vessels at a facility in Istanbul. Ukraine is the world's fifth biggest producer. Around 28 million tons of grain have been exported under the deal since July. Experts warn its termination could have a devastating impact amid a global food crisis.
If the Black Sea deal isn't renewed and Ukraine can't export, then I expect to see food commodity prices to increase substantially again.
Russia had already said last month it might not renew the grain deal beyond its expiry on May 18th. Moscow says a separate but parallel memorandum of understanding it agreed to with the United Nations to help Russia's own agriculture sector in the face of Western sanctions is failing.
Namely, the removal of any obstacles to the export of Russian fertilizers and grain. Practically nothing has been done here.
Despite that claim, figures show Russian wheat exports actually doubled over the past year. Among the Kremlin's demands are the return of the Russian Agricultural Bank to the SWIFT global payment system, the resumption of supplies of farm machinery to Russia, and the lifting of restrictions on insurance and access to ports for Russian ships and cargo.
Certainly, those demands cannot be fully met, and the Russians know it. They're again trying to leverage the food to get all the concessions they can get. They're doing it at a time when it's almost certain that we're going to see an uptick in the conflict with the Ukrainians potentially trying to really push back the Russian positions.
So what if Russia does terminate the grain initiative?
if Russia clearly decides to be aggressive and mine the areas where the ships move, potentially target those ships, then the ships aren't going to move. Insurance rates would go very high. Decisions would be made by ship owners not to come into the Black Sea. And that would really put a strangle on the flow of grains.
The United Nations and the G7 have urged Russia to renew the grain initiative, warning that any disruption could significantly increase food prices and endanger lives in the world's poorest nations. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
Kenyan President William Ruto condemned the leader of a Christian starvation cult and compared the minister's actions to those of terrorists as the death toll rose to at least 73. Trevor Carroll from Reuters reports.
Dozens of bodies have been exhumed in Kenya as part of an investigation into a suspected religious cult. The remains are thought to belong to followers of a Christian cult who believed they would go to heaven if they starved themselves to death. Police began exhuming the bodies on Friday near the coastal town of Malindi in the southeast of the country. The discovery of the mass graves is the latest chapter involving what police call the radicalized pastor, Paul McKenzie. On April 14th, police rescued 15 members of the group, worshippers at the Good News International Church. At least four were found in an emaciated state and died while being rushed to hospital in a police rescue operation. McKenzie, the leader of the church, was subsequently arrested following a tip-off that suggested the existence of shallow graves belonging to his followers. Local media, citing police sources, reported that McKenzie was refusing to eat or drink while in police custody. The manager of a local children's home, Helen McCauley, who has been helping investigators, told reporters children were among the dead.
We have visited some homes in some villages, such as Bethlehem and Judea. And in the villages, you find some parents have lost all their children, or they themselves die. Personally, I have visited about 18 grave sites of children.
She did not say how she knew the graves contained the remains of children. The pastor was previously detained in March in connection to the death of two boys in the area, but later released. Police say on the pastor's advice, the boys' parents had starved and suffocated them. McKenzie reportedly said at the time that he was unaware of the circumstances of the boys' deaths and was the target of hostile propaganda from former colleagues.
That was Reuters reporter Trevor Carroll. And here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. The Australian military will be rapidly transformed to prepare for a possible conflict between China and the United States. An unclassified version of a major defense review published Monday recommends that Australia buy longer-range missiles to counter China's growing threat to, quote, the global rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific. The United Nations said Monday that India will be the world's most populous country by the end of this month, eclipsing an aging China. The milestone raises questions about whether India can repeat the economic success that has made China central to the world's economy and a global leading global power. And Pope Francis says he hopes to travel to his native Argentina in 2024. It would mark the first time that he would step foot in his homeland since becoming pontiff a decade ago. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
One of the many concerns of parents-to-be is, can COVID-19 affect their unborn children? Three recent studies focused on brain development of children born to mothers who were infected with the SARS coronavirus 2. One study from the Massachusetts General Hospital suggests male babies whose mothers had a COVID-19 infection during pregnancy can have a higher risk of brain development disorders. Another from the University of Miami found two cases where the mother's COVID-19 infection passed through the placenta and caused brain damage in their newborns. Meanwhile, a paper from Columbia University suggests that brain development does not slow in babies born to women who had mild COVID-19 during pregnancy. The researchers suggest these issues need further study. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. U.S. President Joe Biden will host South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol later at the White House on Wednesday. The state visit reflects the strength of the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which this year marks its 70th anniversary. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, the allies also face unprecedented challenges.
In some ways, it looks like the same old story. North Korea conducts a provocation, such as this missile launch earlier this month. In response, the U.S. and South Korea hold big displays of military strength, such as these drills on a U.S. aircraft carrier.
Here in Seoul, some version of that has happened for 7 decades, which is how long the U.S. and South Korea have been allies. But as Washington and Seoul celebrate their alliance at the White House this week, several issues of trust have emerged.
Perhaps the biggest is whether South Koreans can trust the U.S. to defend their country. With North Korea now able to threaten the U.S. mainland, many question if Washington would intervene in a conflict. The question is so urgent that President Yoon Suk-yeol has even suggested South Korea could develop its own nuclear weapons if its security concerns are not addressed. To reassure South Koreans, Washington has sent its most powerful military assets for highly visible drills. But Seoul wants more, says analyst Jenny Town.
Is it enough? You know, is it ever really enough? And I'm sure, you know, as North Korea continues to focus on especially ICBM development, you know, I think these demands will continue to grow, even if there is an appreciation for how much more the U.S. has been putting into this.
Another source of tension is South Korea's reluctance to arm Ukraine. Although South Korea has become a major weapons exporter, it says it cannot arm Ukraine directly because of domestic laws. Instead, South Korea has helped indirectly by approving the sale of weapons like these tanks to countries such as Poland that are arming Ukraine. U.S.-South Korea tensions over Ukraine were exposed by the recent leak of U.S. documents, which suggested Washington spied on senior South Korean officials. Seoul has downplayed the incident. But many Koreans remain upset, says scholar Park Won-gon.
Because South Korea and United States, we are allies, and then the leaking information is nothing new. Everybody knows. If the United States really interested in this issue, just give a phone call to our officials, and then South Korean people can be happy to answer all those processes.
For Yoon, perhaps the biggest challenge is a low approval rating at home. Analysts say that may give him limited foreign policy flexibility, as he attempts to align his country more closely with the West. But in Washington, Yoon hopes to encounter a friendlier audience as he celebrates 7 decades of an alliance that is broadly popular in both countries. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
April 24th through the 30th is World Immunization Week. The theme of this year's observance is the big catch-up. The idea is for everyone, especially children, to catch up on the vaccinations they might have missed during the COVID outbreak. And well, if you're like me, you are a bit of a coffee snob. It's what I look forward to the most in the morning, first thing. People worldwide have been paying more for premium cup of coffee these days. But what about paying $100 for one cup? From Panama City, Panama, Oscar Salbaran has the story, narrated by Christina Salcedo Smith.
In Panama, there is coffee, and then there is geisha coffee, which can cost more than $100 a cup. Panama began growing this unique Ethiopian variety in the 1960s because it could survive a fungus that was threatening regular coffee crops. Over time, it became an exotic and expensive drink. Brazil, Colombia, Mexico, Peru, and Honduras are at the forefront of coffee production worldwide. And although Panama is not on the list, its geisha bean has been popular over the years for its quality. Francisco Serracin is the owner of Dompachi Estate.
We cannot be competitive in relation to the volume of coffee that we produce, but we can be competitive with any country in the world in relation to the quality characteristic that we produce. What's more, without fear of being wrong, Panama has become a synonym for quality in the world of coffee.
Producing this coffee costs 3 to 4 times more than producing regular coffee. The reason? An exhaustive quality control process that starts from the sowing of the seed. Janssen's Coffee's Janet Janssen.
It is fed or fertilized more times a year than the other coffees. At harvest time, you pay more for the harvest to be done correctly. Even after the harvest, the coffee is selected before it's distributed, and for all that, you have to pay more.
Japan, Taiwan, China, South Korea, Indonesia, Singapore, and Australia are some of the destinations for Panama Geisha coffee. Its producers say the soil that it is planted in makes the difference. Michael Janssen, also with Janssen Coffee.
To Colombia, to Brazil, to all of Central America. They have taken seeds from Panama, but they have not been able to reproduce the quality of the Panamanian geisha coffee. They still have not done it.
Coffee connoisseurs say it has a silky taste with hints of exotic fruit that makes it worth the money. According to experts, coffee can have over 800 flavor characteristics and over 800 aromatic compounds. Maritza Lisondro, a professional taster and one of the geisha quality control experts, describes some of them.
What makes you differentiate from one to another? A totally citric coffee, pleasant, dim, soft, and sweet.
More than 70 farms currently produce geisha coffee in Panama. And as its fame grows, chances are, so will the price. For Oscar Zulbarán in Panama City, Panama, Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past year, NATO alliance members have been working to implement a new security strategy aimed at making NATO stronger, more resilient, and better positioned for the future, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We're building on the Wales Defense Investment Pledge to invest 2% of our GDP in defense. It is critical that we have the means to replenish stockpiles, to increase the readiness of our forces, to meet force generation commitments for NATO missions and operations, to keep pace with 21st century challenges.
NATO is developing new partnerships, including in the Indo-Pacific. At the recently concluded ministerial, the alliance welcomed the participation of Japan, Australia, South Korea, and New Zealand, who share a vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific region. And of course, the alliance remains relentlessly focused on Russia's aggression against Ukraine, said Secretary Blinken. We've demonstrated again our unity of purpose and our unity of action. I am confident that that will endure for as long as it takes for Ukraine to defend its sovereignty, its territorial integrity, its independence. Secretary Blinken announced additional U.S. arms and equipment for Ukraine.
That includes more ammunition for HIMARS, air defense interceptors and artillery rounds, as well as anti-armor systems, small arms, heavy equipment transport vehicles, and maintenance support. These contributions will continue to enable Ukraine to protect civilian infrastructure from missile and drone attacks, and to hold and retake Ukraine's territory.
At the same time, the United States and Ukraine's partners support meaningful diplomatic efforts that can achieve a peace in Ukraine, said Secretary Blinken.
It has to be a just peace that upholds the principles of the UN Charter, sovereignty, territorial integrity, independence, and it has to be a durable peace that ensures that Russia can't simply rest and refit its troops and then relaunch the war at a time of its choosing.
Until that peace is achieved, the United States, together with allies and partners from around the world, will continue to provide assistance to Ukraine. Amid new challenges to the rules-based order and NATO's collective security, the alliance has emerged stronger and larger than ever. As we prepare for the next NATO summit in Vilnius, said Secretary Blinken, I am confident that we'll continue to meet the challenges of this moment and the time to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.